सब बोलिए हरे कृष्णा
हरे
कृष्णा 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 हरे
हरे
हरे रामा
हरे
रामा रामा
रामा
हरे
हरे।
Receive His grace, Hari Sari Prabhu. Welcome. Would you like to come and speak? So, within our limited time today, I thought to take one segment of my service to Srila Prabhupada, which really means his engagement of me and his guidance of me. And I thought to speak about Madras. In December of 1971, there had been a Pandal program, a very major Pandal program at the LIC grounds near Kanat Circus in Delhi. And after the program, Srila Prabhupada asked the disciples to form a strategy for preaching in India. And he said that they should formulate the strategy first without discussing who would do what. And after they had planned the strategy, then discuss who will do what. In other words, he didn't want the strategy to be based on individuals' personal desires or preferences. In the meantime, Srila Prabhupada received an invitation from Dr. C. Bali, who was the husband of Vaijayanti Mala, who was a famous Bharatanatyam dancer and later, I guess, a film star, to come to Madras. But Srila Prabhupada wanted to take his disciples to Vrindavan. It was to be the first visit of Srila Prabhupada to Vrindavan with his disciples. But at the same time, he wanted someone to go to Madras and... Well, by and large, the devotees wanted to go with Srila Prabhupada to Vrindavan. But somehow I had been convinced that the secret of success in spiritual life is to follow the instructions of the spiritual master, serve the instructions of the spiritual master, and please him. So I volunteered to go, and in Madras I stayed at different people's homes and basically preached as I had heard Srila Prabhupada preach. But in Madras there are many Shaivites, Srila Prabhupada speaks about the rivalry between the Shaivites and Vaishnavas. And then there was another class of so-called intellectuals who were impersonalists, and they thought that what is this childish fighting, you know, Shiva is supreme, Vishnu is supreme, the supreme has no name, no form, no qualities, and he just takes the shape of Shiva or Vishnu, but ultimately everything is one. So why this childish fighting over who is supreme? So early in my stay, I met a man named Mr. Ratnamayer, who had his own religious organization called the Astika Samaj, which had a nice grounds and pavilion, and he seemed to be very enthusiastic. Is that His Holiness Subhat Swami Maharaj? Hare Krishna. Maharaj, would you like to sit? Hare Krishna. Sorry?
How is your health, Maharaj?
Not bad.
Not bad.
I'll just continue because. So, he said, don't worry, I will arrange everything for you, Guru Maharaj. We'll have the program in my pavilion, and I'll do all the invitations and make all the arrangements. So, time passed, and. I started to hear that there was an undercurrent of protest about the way that I was preaching. And even very good friends advised me not to criticize, but just to state in a positive way whatever I want to say about Krishna and devotional service and ISKCON's activities. And he was my host, he was a very nice man. He was a very, very nice man and a very supportive friend. He even advised me that the Gaudiya Mutt in Madras, they don't criticize like you do. And they have a very big Janmashtami celebration every year. Thousands and thousands of people come. So, why can't you preach like them? And I thought about it. I thought about it. Would Srila Prabhupada want me to do that? Is that what Srila Prabhupada would want me to do? And I had my doubts. But anyway, it went on, and I kept hearing more and more. And finally, I thought, maybe I'm doing something wrong. Maybe Krishna is trying to tell me something through all these people who are saying the same thing. So I decided to take their advice, not to criticize, not to enter into controversy, but just to state positively whatever I wanted to say about Krishna and Krishna consciousness. So, with this determination, I had an appointment with an industrialist, and so, as usual, well, he had a big complex, and his residence and office and factory were all in the same compound. So I went into his office and, you know, sat across the desk from him, showed him the picture of our activities, showed him Back to Godhead magazine, showed him Prabhupada's books, explained our activities, explained the life membership program, and asked him to become a life member. He said, "What about Shankaracharya? You've said so many things, but you haven't mentioned Shankaracharya. What about him?" I said, "Yes, he's one of the great acharyas of India, certainly." He said, "Yes, well, what about him? Why haven't you said anything about him?" So I, you know, I tried to answer in a vague, philosophical way, as not to get into another argument. But he kept probing. He kept probing. "What about him? Why haven't you said anything about him? He's one of the great acharyas of India." And then finally, I had to say, "Well, you know, he's an incarnation of Lord Shiva, and he came to teach a veiled form of Buddhism to cheat the atheists." And I took out the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, and I showed him all the quotations, and you know, he was arguing, and I was explaining, and he was arguing, and I was explaining. And I thought, "Oh, well, I tried, but I couldn't do it." So I thought, "Well, that's just the way it is." So packed away all the photos, packed away the Back to Godhead magazines, packed away the books, packed away the life membership form, closed my briefcase, and stood up to leave. And, you know, he was a cultured South Indian gentleman. He escorted me towards the gate. And when we were near the gate, he said, "Before you leave, I would like you to see my temple." And I thought, "Oh no, he's going to have a Shiva Linga, and if I don't offer obeisances to the Shiva Linga, he's going to think I'm offensive or narrow-minded." Or so I looked at his eyes, like, "Do I really have to do this?" And he looked back into my eyes, "Yes, you do." So I smiled, okay. So he took me into his residence, And the deity room was quite big. I mean, for a temple in someone's home, it was quite big. And it was white marble. I was very impressed. And there was a pretty high platform. And on the platform were large marble deities of Radha and Krishna. And I was very happy because there are Vaishnava temples in Madras, but mostly Vishnu. And then there's one Parthasarathi temple, which is just Krishna alone with a mustache. And that was about it in Madras. I was really happy to see Radha and Krishna. And then I looked at him, you know, looked him in the eye and like, so what is this? And he said that actually, oh, Mother Narayani, please have a seat. Ladies, please escort her. So, Hare Krishna. So he said, actually, I and my entire family for many generations have been devotees of Radha and Krishna. I was just testing you. And I am very pleased you did not compromise. So I will be very happy to become your life member. So we went back to his office, took out all the books and magazines and the form, and he wrote out a check for the whole amount in one installment. And then I thought, well, maybe I wasn't doing the wrong thing. But so many people had told me, I still wasn't sure, but maybe I wasn't, but I wasn't sure. So then I went back to the place where I was staying, and there was a letter from Srila Prabhupada. And as I read the letter, the words practically jumped out of the page. And Srila Prabhupada wrote that the fact is that I am the only one in India who is openly criticizing not only demigod worship and impersonalism, but anything that falls short of complete surrender to Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he said, my Guru Maharaj never compromised in his preaching, and I will never compromise in my preaching, and similarly, none of my disciples should ever compromise in their preaching. We must declare it boldly that unless people are prepared to accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrender unto Him, all of their dreams for peace and prosperity will be baffled. So then I thought, all right, well, this seems to be a confirmation, and I continued. Mr. Ratnamayer, in the meantime, you know, I kept trying to pin him down for some dates for the program, but he kept avoiding me. So I wrote Srila Prabhupada, and he said, from the beginning I was doubtful about the arrangement with Mr. Ratnamayer. We should not depend on others to create a venue for our preaching. We will create our own venue. And he said, you know, now what to do? It's already been announced that I will be coming. So if I don't come, our prestige will suffer. So it was sort of a dilemma. But fortunately, we were able to arrange a very nice hall in a very prestigious location, Cathedral Road. And Srila Prabhupada came, and we had very, very successful program for it. Now, during the course of my preaching before Srila Prabhupada came, many people told me that I must meet a very religious man named Mr. Ramakrishna. So I met him, and he was one of those who was very much in the mood that Shiva is supreme, and I was giving my arguments that Krishna is supreme, and he was giving his arguments that Shiva is supreme. And he was a very volatile type of person, and he started to get red in his face and became very agitated and angry. And so we ended up sort of shouting at each other. And anyway, in the end, I tried, you know, to be polite, and he tried to be civil to me, and we parted, but it was a very uneasy truce. But as time went on, I kept meeting people saying, oh, have you met Mr. Ramakrishna? He's such a religious man. You must meet him. He'll certainly like your movement. So again, I was hearing it, and I thought, well, maybe I should try again. And I imagined that he was also hearing the same thing. Oh, have you met the Hare Krishna devotee? They're doing very good work. I'm sure you'll like what they're doing. So I phoned him, and he was very ready to meet me again. Very ready. So I thought, yeah, he's also getting the same thing from the other side. So we began very cautiously, very carefully, but eventually the same point came up. But we didn't want it to become a fight like the last time, but it was heading in that direction, and he was getting more agitated, and I was responding, and then fortunately Krishna gave me the intelligence before it went completely out of control. And I said, you know, I'm just a student. The person you should really speak to is my teacher. Swami Bhaktivedanta, Srila Prabhupada, he'll be coming to Madras soon. Why don't you just continue this discussion with him? So he thought this was a very good idea, and I also did too. And so when Srila Prabhupada came, I arranged for Mr. Ramakrishna to meet him. And, you know, Mr. Ramakrishna gave the background, and then he came to the point, who is supreme? And Srila Prabhupada dealt with the question in a very expert manner. He did not answer the question in the terms in which it was phrased, but he changed the terms of the question. And he said, in Sanskrit, there are two words, puja and bhakti. Generally, in puja, one approaches the deity to get some material return. And in bhakti, one serves the deity only for the sake of pleasing the deity without any demand for any personal return. So he said, generally, people worship Shiva in the mood of puja to get something in return, and devotees worship Krishna in the mood of bhakti, just to please Krishna. So Mr. Ramakrishna said, well, isn't it possible that one could worship Shiva without a desire for some material return? He said, yes, it's possible. He said, just like if someone goes into a liquor shop, generally it's understood that he's going to purchase liquor, but it's possible that he could be going for some other purpose. And then Mr. Ramakrishna said, well, what if one worships Shiva in the mood of bhakti? And Srila Prabhupada said, then that is fine. That is fine. And actually, it's a fact that if one approaches Lord Shiva in the mood of bhakti, desiring to please him without any material desire, he will bring his worshiper to Krishna. There are many vivid examples. Nityananda Prabhu, the temple president in Dallas, he was a Shaivite, but not because he wanted something material, but just by association he became a Shaivite, and eventually Lord Shiva brought him to Krishna. So, there are so many incidents in Madras, but since I'm on this theme, I'll continue a little further. So, Srila Prabhupada was invited to the inauguration of a home temple by a very affluent and aristocratic man in Madras. And so Srila Prabhupada, and there were other holy people who were also invited. So when it came time for the actual inauguration of the temple, there was only enough room for Srila Prabhupada and the other special invitees inside the room. And we disciples were outside the room, but we could sort of see inside, but not very clearly. And in that case, the main deity was Lord Shiva, Shiva Lingam, and all of the saintly persons who had assembled were given flowers to offer, and at the appropriate moment, all the holy people, they offered their flowers to the Shiva Linga. And Srila Prabhupada threw his flowers in the corner. So, you know, we were learning. We were very eager to see what Srila Prabhupada did, how he did things, so we could learn. So after Srila Prabhupada and the other special invitees left the room, we went in and we saw in the corner there was a little deity of Krishna. So many events. But maybe I will skip ahead to one, I think, very instructive. Well, yeah, maybe one humorous one. Yes, this was at a certain stage. Bhavananda Prabhu and Achyutananda Prabhu and one new bhakta, an Indian boy, were with me in Madras. And on Ekadasi, you know, I was very enthusiastic. Bhavananda Prabhu was very enthusiastic. And so we, you know, we said, we want to go out and preach. And Achyutananda said, you know, it's Ekadasi. I don't think it's auspicious to go out and preach today. We thought, oh, you know, auspicious, inauspicious, this is preaching, this is beyond such considerations. So the two of us went out, leaving Achyutananda Prabhu behind. And we had been on the road walking maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And clouds gathered, the sky opened up, it started to pour down rain, like sheets of rain. We were getting soaked. But we were determined, because we were on our mission. And it was raining and raining and raining, and there was hardly any vehicles on the road, or you know, no rickshaws or anything. So we're just walking. And eventually, the whole road was covered with water. So we were walking along, and suddenly, Bhavananda Prabhu ends up being about 2.5 feet lower than I am. It turns out that there was a drainage canal running alongside the road, but because the water was so high, we couldn't see it. And so he ended up stepping into it, and he was almost waist deep in water. So when I met Srila Prabhupada, I related that incident to him. And I said that that everything was one, that we couldn't we were not distinguishing, like the Bhagavad Gita says, so we weren't distinguishing between high and low, but we were seeing everything equally. And Srila Prabhupada replied, yes, but Bhavananda is more advanced than you, because your knowledge is only theoretical, and his was real life. And, you know, I took that to be true. I still think it is true, because Srila Prabhupada had a way of expressing profound truths in humorous ways. But anyway, during this period, I met and began to cultivate the Chief Justice of the Madras High Court, Mr. Veeraswamy, and he was very enthusiastic. He actually wanted to become a disciple of Srila Prabhupada's. And Srila Prabhupada was open to the idea. But anyway, so after this program at the AVM Kalyan, I can't believe I'm forgetting the name. AV Mayapam Chetir Kalyana Mandapam, on Cathedral Road. So the Chief Justice arranged a big program for Srila Prabhupada in some grounds, I think near Adyar, a little outside the city. And he invited all the high court judges and high court advocates and the elite of the city. And it was very impressive. And Srila Prabhupada and the disciples were on the stage. And Srila Prabhupada began speaking about the six Goswamis, how they were very highly placed in society. Rupa and Sanatan were the chief minister and finance minister of Nawab Hussain Shah, and how they gave up everything to join the mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And so Srila Prabhupada was appealing to them in the same way, that they should give up everything and join the mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But I think he knew that there was a lot of impersonal contamination. And at one stage, he asked them, all these really aristocratic, highly placed people, to repeat after him, "Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead." And some of them did. They actually repeated, "Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead." So after the program, we went to the Chief Justice's residence for prasad, to spend some time with the Chief Justice and his family and to honor prasad. So at that time, Srila Prabhupada's Shyamasundara and Malati were there with their small daughter, Saraswati, who was just maybe 4 years old. And the Chief Justice presented Srila Prabhupada a beautiful sandalwood garland, some nice presentation, and a beautiful silver murti of Krishna. So Srila Prabhupada was sitting on a chair, and all the disciples were on the floor, the carpet, and he held this statue in front of Saraswati. And said, "Who is this?" He said, "Krishna." And then he sort of removed the statue from her vision and then hid it behind his back in such a way that she didn't see what he did. And then Prabhupada said, "Saraswati, where is Krishna?" And then she realized that, oh yes, where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? She was looking everywhere. The eyes were darting everywhere in the room. She couldn't find Krishna. And again, Prabhupada repeated, "Saraswati, where is Krishna?" And again, her anxiety increased. And she was looking everywhere, going to the different devotees, But she did not find Krishna. And Prabhupada said, Saraswati, where is Krishna? She was like so filled with anxiety to find Krishna. And then one of the devotees said, Saraswati, who has Krishna? Malati said? Malati said, according to Parvati Mata. Sorry? Malati, Saraswati's mother, according to Parvati, said, no, it's just the way it is sometimes. Nothing personal, but I just had a talk with Jayadvaita Swami, how most authorities agree that we generally have the idea that memories are stored away and then we draw upon them as required, but most authorities now agree that memories are constructed. And writing about Prabhupada or any historical topic, it's actually a very humbling exercise, because you realize how subjective your memory can be. But anyway, fortunately, we have a lot of recorded material of Srila Prabhupada's and a lot of transcripts on folio. So we can try to verify our recollections with reference to verifiable evidence. And I'm sure Malati was the one who said it. Sorry? Ah, okay. Well, that's...
She is already in the hall. She puts him in now.
Okay. So anyway, there's no doubt. Parvati heard it 35 years ago, and this is what she remembers from 35 years ago. There is no doubt. Absolutely no doubt. I accept that. So, coming back to my recollection, and I don't remember anyone else saying it, so we'll say, I'm sure it was Malati. So Malati said, Saraswati, who has Krishna? And Saraswati's face lit up with recognition and her eyes opened wide, and she said, Prabhupada has Krishna. And then she came running up to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada brought the little Krishna statue up from behind his back and held it right in front of Saraswati. And this was a very profound instruction, a very deep revelation that Prabhupada has Krishna. And if our anxiety for Krishna, if our desire for Krishna becomes sufficiently strong and intense, he can deliver Krishna to us. And it reminded me of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's song to Vaishnava Guru, that Krishna is yours. You have the power to deliver him to me. So I am simply running behind you, shouting, Krishna, Krishna. So, but that that desire has to be very deep. It's not a cheap thing. It has to be very deep. Our first host in Madras was Mr. Balu. And Mr. Balu, he did things that appeared to be like sahajya. Like we actually came and stayed with him before Srila Prabhupada came. And he had a deity room, very beautiful deity of Krishna, dressed in black. So I asked him, you know, why do you dress the deity in black? He said, well, if we don't dress him in black, his effulgence is too blinding. So we dress him in black. Another thing I noticed, he didn't offer obeisances when he went into the deity room. And I asked him why. He said, well, we worship Krishna as our son, so we wouldn't offer obeisances to our son. So this was not the standard that we had learned from Srila Prabhupada. But he's a very cultured man, I mean, in that sense, very cultured. They're very traditional. The wife, I'm not suggesting anything here, it's just the culture. The wife would always take rest after her husband, and she would always get up before her husband. And she would cook and serve him prasad, and only after he had taken prasad would she eat. And she was a very good cook. If you ever want like good idli, chutney, dosa, sambar, that would be a place to go. So it was sort of going on like that, very cultured and hospitable, but a little different. So one day they came into Srila Prabhupada's room, and Mr. Balu said to Srila Prabhupada, Swamiji, he's with his wife, Swamiji, please recite Rasalila. And Srila Prabhupada replied that Rasalila is a very advanced subject. And it comes in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And one should thoroughly study the first 9 cantos before coming to the 10th canto. And even within the 10th canto, the 5 chapters dealing with the Rasalila are the most confidential, like that. But, you know, Mr. Balu, he was very insistent in it. He repeated, Swamiji, my wife and I plead with you. Please recite Rasalila. And then he said, actually, Rasalila can be discussed when one is liberated from material desires and attachments. And he said, when one is no longer attached to home, and then Prabhupada sort of, you know, in a subtle way indicated Mr. Balu's nice mansion. And when one is detached from wife and children, and then there's like a picture of his son on the wall, he's sort of like, and children, it sort of like indicated the picture of his son on the wall. When one is completely freed from all material attachment, one can discuss Rasalila. Even then, Mr. Balu He was so determined. He said, "Swamiji, please, my wife and I beg you, please recite Vasudeva." And then Srila Prabhupada said, "You may be qualified to hear Vasudeva, but I do not feel I am qualified to speak. So please ask someone else." Yes, one day, Srila Prabhupada started talking about his books, and he gave like a very brief summary in one line of each book. And yes, he mentioned the Bhagavad Gita as it is. He mentioned the nectar of devotion. He said it is pure nectar. He mentioned the Krishna book, that it is philosophy and pastimes woven together in such a way that you don't even realize you're getting philosophy while you're reading the pastimes. Well, maybe we'll end here because there are so many senior devotees. They could add anything they would like, or anyone can add or ask questions. We have a few more minutes. Yes.
What was the first thing that happened to you that you accepted this movement, system of the movement, and you made up your mind that Srila Prabhupada Kumai Guru Maharaj? What was the first thing that happened to you?
That's a very good question. He asks, what brought me to the movement? What convinced me to accept the movement? Well, when I was in the university, I was seeking perfection. And by reading different books, I came to the conclusion that I needed a guru. And then my focus became finding my guru. And whenever I heard that there was some Swami or Yogi or Master, I would want to meet him. And I was a student at Brandeis University, and the chairman of the psychology department, I was in the psychology department, was Abraham Maslow, and he had developed a theory of self-actualization. And so he and other members of the department invited many philosophers and spiritual teachers to the university. So I would meet them. There was one hatha yogi who came. He was really the picture of Indian spirituality. He had long hair, flowing hair, and a beard, and nice orange robes, and a twinkle in his eye, and he would grin and smile and chuckle a lot. And so I went to his lecture, and he said that by yoga you can gain control over your involuntary muscles, and you can actually command your intestines. I forget the terms, but the one you say advance, and then it moves it along, then transverse, one advance, then it moves along, then descending, and then it goes down, and then colon, and then release, and then it comes out. So I thought this was very intriguing, but I wasn't sure how this was related to my quest for perfection. But I thought, anyway, let me meet him personally. So after the talk, he was going to the airport, and I wanted to ride with him, but they said his car was full, but I could ride with his students. I said, okay. So I rode with the students, and the main topic among them was the different types of food they were missing since they joined the ashram. And I thought, oh, this doesn't sound right. I mean, they were just with their Guru Maharaj, and he just gave a talk, and they're thinking about all the food they missed since joining the ashram. But anyway, they're just the students. Let me speak to the master. So he got to the airport, and Swamiji was very warmly and tightly embracing one of his lady disciples, young lady disciples. I thought, this is not my perfect master. So then there was a Zen master who was a certified, approved Zen master, certified by another certified enlightened Zen master from Japan. So I went to his ashram, and he had like a three-day, like a weekend retreat. So we all sat in a room. We had to sit with our back straight, staring at the wall, doing some sort of exercise. And the master would walk around the room with a stick. And if he felt that you were, we're not sitting properly, or your mind was wandering, he would strike you with the stick. So, you know, I did it. I was really searching, and I tried it. I thought, this is sort of tedious. And I also didn't like the idea of him coming around with a stick. I mean, I wanted self-realization. And the students all seemed a bit morose. That also concerned me. But again, I thought, well, they're just the students. You really can't tell. I need to meet the master. So after the morning session, there was there were meals. These, you know, I guess traditional wooden tables and benches. And some of the students were discussing with the master, and the master said, I lost my temper, I shouldn't have done that. I thought, well, that doesn't sound right. But then I had read in Zen books that the enlightened souls appear ordinary. You can't really tell who they are. So I thought, well, maybe this is part of it. He just like appears to be ordinary. So, you know, I sort of withheld judgment. Nothing really dramatic happened over the weekend. You know, I certainly wasn't convinced that he was my perfect master, but I didn't discount him completely. And then just a little after I got back to Brandeis, Houston Smith had invited the same Zen master to give a talk at MIT. So I went. And someone in the audience asked him about Vedanta. And he replied, I have enough trouble keeping up with Zen. Don't ask me about Vedanta. And then I thought, you know, he's not my perfect master. I went to another demonstration, not by the guru, but by one of his teachers, that, you know, you meditate 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening, that one. And then I found out that before they give you your mantra for, I'm not sure, a week or whatever it is, for some period of time, you have to follow certain regulative principles. So then I thought, you know, if it's good to follow the regulative principles, why should it be just for 6 days? I mean, why shouldn't it? So that didn't sound right. I thought, oh, maybe this isn't it. Then I heard there was a psychology professor at Antioch University in Ohio who was supposed to be enlightened. So I drove to Antioch, and it was Friday afternoon. I was great expectations. I went to his office. I met his secretary. I said, I want to meet Professor so-and-so. He's playing golf. He's playing golf. She said, yes, it's his Zen. He's not my perfect master. So it went on like this. I'm abbreviating it. There are more very interesting ones, but we don't have time. Then finally, I almost despaired that there's no hope. There's no hope. Because I somehow I had like a mental image of what my guru looked like. And he didn't have hair. And all the other, you know, swamis and yogis, they all had long flowing hair and beards. And I basically was ready to give up hope. I guess it was, well, whatever day it was, I had arranged with some friends to see a movie at Harvard Square. But then I noticed on campus there were posters saying, lecture, Bhagavad Gita as it is, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, you know, such a... So by then I was already almost hopeless, like I mentioned. So I went home. I was already vegetarian, so my friends came over and we had, I guess, soup and salad and pasta. And then it was time to go to the movie. And I kept thinking of that poster. And I didn't know how to break it to my friends. But I just said, you know, there's a lecture on campus. And I think I want to go to that lecture. And my friends got very upset, especially one lady friend. She really got upset. And I really didn't want to displease them. So I tried to go along with their idea, but something in my heart kept impelling me. It was just like forcing me. So, and the lady said, you know, why do you always have to be running after these swamis and yogis? Why can't we be like other people? And I said, okay. This will be the last one I ever go to. we'll go to the late show. We'll go to the late show. But let's go to this. So we went to the, it was in the auditorium of the psychology department. And, you know, we came in because of this whole discussion. I mean, we missed the main lecture. But Seth Srupa was leading the kirtan. And Prabhupada was on stage. And the sound of the kirtan was reverberating off the bare brick walls of the auditorium. The devotees were dancing in ecstasy. And students, one by one, students were standing up from their seats and jumping on the stage and joining the chanting and dancing. And that's what I felt like doing. But I looked both sides at my friend. I thought, oh, they will never accept this. They'll never accept this. So I stood up. I was sort of like swaying back and forth in front of my seat. And then Satsuruba made an announcement that, because they didn't have any cars then, so he said, if anyone is driving to Harvard Square or Boston, please let us know, because the devotees need a ride. And we were going to Harvard Square to the movie. So I went out to the lobby of the auditorium, and the first devotee who spoke to me ever was Bharadraj Prabhu, famous singer and artist. And it's like he was so intoxicated with Krishna consciousness. He just started saying, when Krishna showed his universal form to Arjuna, it was brighter than hundreds and thousands of suns. And Arjuna was shaking and trembling, and he said, Krishna, please show me your original form. And then Krishna showed him his four-handed form, and then his two-handed form. He was just like in ecstasy. It's like a complete ecstasy. So I said, you know, I'm driving to Harvard Square. If any of you need a lift, I can take you. Yes. So I had a red Rambler station wagon, and I don't know how they all fit. They all squeezed in. And I was the driver, and there was a lady devotee named Janava in the front seat, and that lady friend. And then my friend Gary, who's like my best friend, and another friend named Paul, and then Satsvarupa, and Vaikunthanath Saradia, the early devotees, Bharadraj. So in the back, I could hear my friend Gary arguing with Satsvarupa. And saying that everything is void. And Satsvarupa was saying, there is nothing void in the creation of God. So I was listening in the front seat, and I thought, you know, I had it all figured out. I was like those people in Madras. So, at that time. So I turned around and said something that I thought was very profound, and which I thought would solve the whole problem. So I said, it is not something I've read. It is not void, and it is not not void. But to give it a name, we call it the void. Well, that profound statement had absolutely no effect at all. They kept on arguing. So I thought, well, let me ask my questions that are really of concern to me. So I asked Janava about Yogananda, because I'd read Autobiography of the Yogi, so I asked her about Yogananda. Oh, he's just a shopkeeper. You go to his ashram, whatever you want, he has it in stock. You want Krishna, he has Krishna. You want Shiva, he has Shiva. Whatever you want, he has it in stock. And he has a monument to Mahatma Gandhi as a leader of world peace. Mahatma Gandhi wasn't working for world peace, he was working for India's political independence. He doesn't even know who Mahatma Gandhi is. I thought, wow, she is really speaking with authority. I had never heard these things before. Then I asked her about Zen. And she said that this world, it is like images on a movie screen. They appear real, but actually they're illusory. And if you draw your attention back from the screen, you'll find there's a beam of light. And that beam of light comes to a point. And that point is the void. But beyond that point, there's a light bulb, and beyond that light bulb, there's a person. And I thought, wow, this is the best explanation of Zen I've ever heard, better than I heard from any Zen master or read in any Zen book. But it goes beyond Zen to something that I never heard before. So I thought, wow. You know, she speaks with so much authority. But she's just a young girl. And I knew that she couldn't be speaking on her own authority, that she must be speaking on some other authority. So I was fascinated. I thought all my questions were being answered. So then we got to Harvard Square. I stopped the car, let the devotees out, and then I realized, oh my God, I don't know where they live. I don't know how to reach them. So I parked the car and ran after them. And the first devotee I reached was Petit Pavan. He moves a little slowly, which was good for the occasion. And he was also like totally entranced by the philosophy. He said, "Do you see all these people here? They're like sleepwalkers. They don't know who they are or where they're going. They're just like walking in their sleep." Like everything that every devotee said was just mesmerizing. It was just mesmerizing. And he kept speaking and I kept listening. And then suddenly the sound of honking horns broke through my consciousness. And I was, oh my God, I parked my car at Harvard Square. All the traffic is backed up. So I said, quick, give me the phone number, give me the address. So he gave me the details. And I went back to the car. And then next day went to the temple. And the temple room was packed. It was just a small storefront, 95 Glendale Avenue, Alston. And Srila Prabhupada was speaking. But he spoke in a very, what to me it seemed like a very thick accent. So I couldn't follow it so well. And I wasn't familiar with the subject. But I was straining to understand. And then he said, you know, Manusyanam Sahasri Sukhasthit Yatri Siddhati, that out of many thousands of men, one will seek perfection. And I thought, that's me. He's talking about me. So, and then, you know, Vasudeva, one who surrenders to Krishna is Mahatma. So then, afterwards, he asked for questions. And I, you know, I raised my hand, I asked the question that had been burning in my heart for so long. And I said, there's so many swamis and masters and yogis, and each one recommends a different process of self-realization, and each one says his is best. So how do I know which is actually best? And eventually he said, what is your goal? Do you want to become God, or do you want to serve God? And this was a very intelligent response, because I'm asking what is the best means. But he was asking what is the end, because you will choose the means according to the end. So he went on to explain that if your goal is to become God, that means you're not God now. And how can not God become God? He said, God is God. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God by yoga or meditation. And then he said, Krishna is God. He's God when he's playing on the lap of his mother. He's God when he's speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God by yoga or meditation. And then he said that if you sow the seed of service to God and water it by chanting, God will give you the sun, shine, and all the conditions favorable to help your service develop. So he said, God is in your heart. He's ready to help you. You can become godly, but you cannot become God. And yeah, if God is in your heart, he's ready to help you. But if you want to become God, you're only cheating yourself. Why should God help the competition? So, then I felt that Prabhupada was seeing right into me, that he knew everything about me. He was seeing through me. He was seeing through the walls of the temple room, down the highway to my apartment, into my apartment, into my bathroom, to the wall of my bathroom where I had written in very ornate inscribed lettering, you are God. I just felt Prabhupada knew everything, and he's looking at that sign, my handwritten sign. So he said, so what do you think? You want to serve God or you want to become God? So by then I understood that the desire to become God was, it was impossible. Not just impossible, it was abominable. And that I should serve God. So I started to say, I want to serve God. But I knew that Prabhupada already knew everything and that I couldn't cheat him. So I started to say, I want to serve God, but actually I realized I wanted to become God. And he said, yes. So I surrendered. I knew that he was my perfect master. He was the one I was looking for. I bowed my head in obeisance. And I knew he was my perfect master who I had been looking for. So that's... And I kept my head down for a long time. Partly in surrender, but partly because I felt I had been exposed by Srila Prabhupada. And I imagined that if I looked around the room, everyone would be like looking at me and scowling like, he wanted to become God. He wanted to become God. He wanted to take Krishna's place. So I kept my head down for a long time. And meanwhile, the devotees had brought Prabhupada a large plate of prasad. And he said, I am not God. I cannot eat all of this. So he took a little and he said to distribute. And I could hear signs that indicated that the devotees were taking prasad and they were in a happy mood. And I thought it was safe to lift my head up. And you know, I looked around the room and everyone was smiling and blissful and happy and they didn't seem to be holding anything against me, and that was my introduction to Krishna consciousness. And actually, Parvati suggested I could begin at the beginning, but I thought if I could begin at the beginning, it would take a long time. But by this question, I came back to the beginning, and we'll see on future occasions how to continue. Thank you all very much.